Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Larry Berman and Ira Harris. Larry is a co-founder, chief investment officer, portfolio manager of ETF Capital Management. He has 30 plus years of industry experience. He's a chartered market technician, CMT. Prior to founding ETF Capital Management, he served for CIBC World Markets as chief technical strategist. He led the technical and quantitative research department there, and he was ranked as Canada's top three analysts. Ira is an independent trader, hedge fund manager, global macro consultant, trading foreign currencies, equities, bonds, and commodities for over 40 years. He was also a CME director from 1997 to 2003, and also most recently. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Hi, glad to be here.
Great. I thought today we'd do a focus on analysis of the financial markets, also within the economy, what's happening, what your thoughts are there. And just to begin with, wanted to get an insight into your approach into technical analysis. Larry, if you want to give an overview of how you approach the markets.
Well, I'll tell you, in almost 35 years now, from the very beginnings of reading some of the, you know, the books that everybody knows to where I am today is night and day different. When you're an analyst, which I was for most of my career, the last sort of 14 years as a portfolio manager, and it's night and day different what you do with your own P&L, your own private account, and then when you become a fiduciary running money for other people, which I am now running public mutual funds and private pools, it's night and day different how you approach investing. And so I've always combined fundamentals and technicals. Fundamentals help us in what to invest in, and the technicals, you know, tell us when to invest. But being an analyst, again, you can have a price target. You can change your price target. Nobody really cares. Hopefully you get it right more than wrong. But once you have a P&L tracking you, it's night and day different. And then you throw on that fiduciary obligation, and what you can do in your own individual account is very, very different than what you can do in, you know, in a public trust position.
Mm-hmm. And Larry, to what extent do you incorporate fundamental analysis together with technical analysis?
Well, it's huge. It's always been the cornerstone. You mentioned I have a CMTL. I'm also a chartered financial analyst and a charter holder, as they permit us to say. And that means I can, if I want, to dig into the income statement and balance sheet and understand the fundamentals. But being from the technical school, before I was in the fundamental school, it was about market behavior, and that everybody's collective opinion, whether they're fundamentally or technically driven, is in price. So marrying both of them together is pretty critical. You can do some basic screening and get rid of 50% of the S&P 500 companies right off the bat because they have bad balance sheets or whatever. And then we can use our technicals to help, you know, decide when do we buy it, and perhaps a little bit about, you know, overweight, underweight, based on relative strength, for example, which is one of my favorite methodologies.
Yeah, and Ira, did you want to relate some of your approach from a technical and fundamental analysis?
Well, I begin with the fundamentals, but I've been doing this for over 43 years, being a trader, but I came to the market with the fundamentals. The fundamentals help me establish how I want to proceed, and I use the technicals to confirm some of my analysis, of course, and more importantly, to be able to actively run low risk plays. And I rely on the fundamentals. I rely on the technicals so much for establishing my risk parameters and adhering to them in a very disciplined manner. So I quite understand what Larry's about. So if he was managing my money, that would give me great comfort. So I come from a very similar school, but the fundamentals are primary for me.
Great. And Larry, what are your thoughts now on what's happening, especially in the last week in the financial markets? Lots of volatility going on. Can you elaborate on your current thoughts?
Well, I think we've lost free and open price discovery. The market's turned into a financial condition index, you know, for the Fed, which means the Fed put. I recall reading a piece a couple months back from Danielle DiMartino Booth, who I think she highlighted something that that Powell had written or said in a Fed meeting going back to 2012 or 13, where Bernanke wanted support for more QE. And he said, you know, basically, Ben, only if we're going to unwind this at some point. And it was like, yeah, absolutely. And so when Powell became chair of the Fed, the thought was that he would be, that Fed put would be under question. Well, of course, we now know that Fed put is not only well in place, it's deep, deep, deep in place. He made the mistake of using the word autopilot in December 18, and very soon thereafter had to reverse Fed course from raising rates to cutting rates. And again, the whole idea of price discovery and free and open markets now, you got to call into question. And it makes it very hard fundamentally to say, well, what is fair value? And so I think we're going to see more of this, these kind of manic markets where it gets bubble-esque. I mean, the valuations for many things are off the charts.
And your current thoughts, Ira?
Let me give a little more color to what Larry talked about. So, yes, with Danny Martino Booth, who we've done some podcasts with, Richard.
Yeah.
But I will tell you this, Larry, on June 27th, 2016, I happened to be at a symposium in Chicago, and Jerome Powell was not yet Fed chair, but it was right after Brexit vote. And it was a and I was at the symposium, and I asked him a question after speaking, after he talked about some things. But I asked him about, especially following Brexit, who guarantees the ECB's balance sheet? And without blinking, he just answered it by saying they have a printing press. Now, that's an enormously big statement from where I sit, because I'm a global macro analyst. So my work always proceeds top down, and then I get an overall view. And if I want to proceed, look at things in a more micro sense, I will look at individual equities. But most of my work is certainly top down. And when I heard him say that, it really cold feet, because I go, wow, that's not the way I would have preferred to hear that answer. And I'm with you. So when you make that note of being on autopilot December of 2018 and then pivoting as he could, I was with him is when he was raising rates and or shrinking the balance sheet. When he pivoted, I said, well, he really is that mindset. And then I stopped being a Powell fan, and everything he's done since then. I'm not one who just keep throwing stuff at it. I'm as Richard, as we've discussed quite a bit. I'm more bothered now because the Fed has become a social justice ministry, because they've gone down the road of they want to solve unemployment. And I'm not making a moral judgment about that, but it is a central bank have a fiduciary responsibility to many players. But when they say that through no fault of their own, it's going to really, inflation is not even to me on their radar screen whatsoever. It's gibberish when they talk about it, because they are going to be pursuing back to that 3.5% unemployment level. And especially to ensure that those who have lost jobs or had their workload cut through no fault of their own are are satisfied. So it's a long haul here, but it makes me very skeptical about the Fed's relationship with the overall financial system.
Yeah, ultimately, I think, Ira, we do get back to full employment, but it's because the size of the pie is shrinking and the demographics, people are just going to age out of the workforce compared to the younger folks coming in. And I'm not sure population demographics are going to support it. So I think we can get back to full employment again, but it's because the pie is shrinking, not necessarily economic growth.
You know, I agree with you. That's a really good point. Except that for these last 12, 13 years, and every time they bring it up about the Fed, you know, well, you know, why was the unemployment? The largest group who increased their presence in the workforce over this 12 years were people 60 years old to 75 years old. And I know plenty of them. Thank God I've been successful enough that I could manage my way through this. And this is what I have done for my entire career. But I know plenty of people who cannot retire anymore, who would have loved to have been out of the workforce, but didn't have aggressive structures for their retirement plan, were probably in 70 or 80% in bonds, who have absolutely been forced to sustain themselves in the workforce. And actually, if I was employing people and I could hire 65-year-old people who were in good health and had all that wisdom, and actually their insurance, their medical insurance becomes a whole different factor because they go on Medicare, I'm keeping these people. I'm not making room for anybody else because it's much easier dealing with these people, and they have a lot of business experience and wisdom that I can attain for less money. They just need to be in the workforce. So it will be interesting to watch these demographics play out, I think, going ahead, because the Fed's going to be at zero for far longer.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. But that doesn't bode well then. If that's the case, and we see a lot more of that, that doesn't bode well for the young people coming out of school.
No, I think that's a big part of the problem, by the way. And yet yeah. The economic model. So that falls because it just doesn't, you know, we're so geared to a 65 retirement age, but I just don't see it.
Other than demographics, how do you see monetary policies from central banks and fiscal policies from governments affecting the financial markets currently? Larry?
Well, I think it's broken. I mean, it's clear the path of monetary policy has added to inequality issues. It's clear the bottom third doesn't have a nickel between paychecks, surplus, and our mounting debts. As time passes, there's going to be a colossal burden on government for social benefits. And frankly, the math doesn't work anymore. So I've been, you know, saying the system's broken for a long time, but free money and unlimited printing presses can mask over a lot of bad. And, you know, all the economic growth in the last decade since the great financial crisis has been leverage. There's been, you know, 0.5% of population growth globally. There's been 0.5%, maybe a little more than that, of productivity. And beyond that, it's all been leverage. And I don't see a change to that, you know, so you've got to change the educational system. There's a lot more things that we have to do policy-wise that has nothing to do with monetary policy to fix it. I love Donald. I'm not a Donald Trump fan by any stretch. I love the message, make America great again. He hasn't done it. Boosting the stock market gives you the K, not a breadth of economic robustness. And So I think monetary policy has to be rethought. Sadly, we're going to an MMT world, which I think in one respect is good because that could potentially lift the bottom half significantly, but it's got all kinds of ramifications for debt and balance sheet that, you know, might be beyond my pay grade to analyze.
And Ira, your thoughts?
Listen, there's so much on the table here, and I agree. You know what? The Fed is going to wear this. They like to, you know, they like to find comfort in that Wall Street chair Zeman, but I'm not as our friend Chris Whalen put out a piece today. Not so much Main Street, and I think Main Street is struggling. Even with the Fed policy and the fiscal stimulus, which should be directed at Main Street, I think was not helped by Friday's unemployment data, because now the Republicans can sit there and go, see, we're getting growth back. Things are improving. We don't have to be as dynamic. I think the Democrats have they overplayed a weak hand. Not that I didn't understand why they wanted to overplay it, but it now looks they're putting the president in a situation where he, by executive orders, can absolutely magnify the optics of him doing his best to alleviate the pain on Main Street, while the Democrats are only concerned about large urban centers and Wall Street. We are at some very, very interesting moments now.
And Larry, can you explain like the terms of volatility in the last week, like delta factors, gamma factors, how you see this as being played out?
So I was reading Jason Gopeford, who's sentiment trader analysis. He does some excellent work. And he had looked at the small options traders, and he was making an analogy, saying, you know, if it was all you know, the big Japanese firm that was being the big whale, they wouldn't be doing these tiny little trades.
SoftBank,
yeah. And but if you look at all the trades really this year, the vast majority of them are, you know, under 50 contracts. And that tends to be mom and pop day trader retail that's trading around, you know, couple thousand shares at a time. But the amount that they've spent in premium in recent months is colossal. Equates to something close to 2% of market cap. And the gamma effect, so gamma, of course, is the rate of change of delta. So as you buy a call or a call spread, the market maker has to buy the underlying as a hedge. And the more you buy and the more it goes up, it kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. That's the gamma effect, convexity, if you will, of the trade. And so it's all good when it's going up, but when the bubble pops, and it appears to have in the last couple of days, then that needs to get unwound as these options expire. So it'll be very interesting to see the September quarterly expiry next week. And I suspect we stay quite weak into that as a lot of this gamma gets unwound.
And your thoughts, Ira, on the volatility?
You know what, my thoughts are really secondary, because Larry is much more prepared on this. This is not my strength, and I find it interesting what he's saying, because I want to hear him speak to this. When I see what took place and SoftBank has done, now it may not all be them, but we don't know, in fact, how leveraged up they were here. And it doesn't surprise me and let me step back from it. They may have overstepped some of their confidence. We saw the way their stock reacted in Japan over Sunday and Monday, or Monday, Tuesday in Japan. as the stock went down, but they may have leveraged themselves up into some positions that, due to the, who they are and the way that they operate, we only see well after the fact. But Masa-san took a huge hit, and we still don't even know how big a hit on WeWork, because I don't think that that's been, that story's been fully told yet. And COVID was the, I think, the final stake in its heart in the way that it dealt with the real estate market. But I think that there is there'll be a lot of questions about Masa-san, and the fact that because of the way that they operate historically, is some of this considered to be considered insider trading? Because is he leveraging up deals that he knows are taking place that he may in fact be bidding on or have bidded on? So I have a lot of questions there, but he's far more astute to answer that.
Well, say the numbers that I had heard on the small options trade or read about, I haven't vetted them personally, but I assume the source is reliable, that whatever SoftBank did, the small trader, the millions and millions of small traders were 10x SoftBank and amounted to, again, somewhere around 2%, the impact, about 2% of the market cap of the S&P 500, concentrated in, you know, the handful of big names that, that have been, you know, riding the markets higher by market cap. Mm-hmm. So there's a concentration, there's size, and there's this gamma effect that could be equally as painful on the way down as it was on the way up. Speaking from someone who was tilted on the short side, and you know, I've missed the last, you know, hundreds of points on the S&P here, because in my world, in my modeling, when things get silly, I get hedged, and I don't care if I miss the upside, but. But a lot of people have that fear of missing out, and they want to get on board, and momentum feeds momentum.
Right.
But I'm a fundamental, at my core, fair value guy. And, you know, I still think the S&P is worth something below 2000. If you want to talk about the old days and how we value things, forget about free money and why the multiple should be higher for a minute. But I think it's a huge impact in the short run here. In the long run, it kind of works its way out. But in the short run here, it's going to have a big impact day to day.
And in your relative analysis work, Larry, how do you see short, medium term outlooks for like industry sectors or asset classes, meaning commodities, fixed income, currencies, equities, or even geographies?
You know, on my Berman's Call BNN show, going back a couple years when gold was in the 1,100 range, I looked at long-term charts, relative strength, long-term, and I thought, you know, gold stocks are about the cheapest they've been in, you know, in my lifetime. And I thought, you know, as a someone who looks for intrinsic value, I thought it was interesting Warren Buffett just jumped on the gold bandwagon recently. But, you know, as intrinsic value was exceptional, it's still really cheap. When I look at the street and what they're valuing, you know, they look at gold and they say, okay, gold at 2000, 1900, next year's price is 1800, 1700, 1500. None of these analysts believe that gold is real and that it's very likely going to remain at very high levels given the propensity of the Fed to print. And there's no way a balanced budget's going to be politically palatable probably the rest of my lifetime. And so the only way out is monetization, which, you know, has implications for inflation, not with the output gap as wide as it is today, but has implications for inflation, has implications, therefore, for broad commodity prices, et cetera. And you have to weigh that against, you know, the output gaps and the fundamental demand of a weaker overall economy. So I think one trade that makes sense almost no matter what happens in the with the White House and politics is infrastructure. and not infrastructure like pipelines. I'm talking infrastructure as building roads and houses and everything that's related to base metals, basically steel. So I think that there's a lot of reflation in that trade to come, which is very attractive as well. So there are some pockets of value here. But most of the things on a relative strength basis, I love technology measured in 5 years, 10 years, 20. It's crazy expensive almost wherever you look. But relative, you want to buy every pullback, not today, but you want to buy every pullback because long term, those fundamental relative trades make sense. And you want to always buy into pullbacks in what, you know, what should be a long term trade. So lots of things here, but right now there's nothing that I would call cheap. Banks are relatively cheap, but it's the yield curve and net interest margins that probably don't improve much. The yield curve steepening from 5s to 30s doesn't help net interest margins, and that's where we're going to get the vast majority of steepening, not in the funding markets to the mortgage market, the sort of the 5-year window, and the lending mark, corporate lending. That spread isn't going to be better improving for years and years and years, as long as interest rates are anchored near zero and we have presumptive yield curve control.
Do you think yield curve control will be implemented by some central banks?
Well, it is. I mean, effectively, they talked about the lower bound being anchored to zero. And if you look at the Fed funds curve or the Eurodollar curve, 6-7 years, right, of expectations today with an occasional chance that we go to negative rates. And I don't think we'll see negative rates in terms of the money markets. But we could, as a flight to safety into treasuries, assuming they don't crank up the printing presses too much, the U.S. 10-year is the most attractive asset on the planet relative to every other government bond yield that isn't an emerging market today. So the money's going to go somewhere if it comes out of stocks again, and the treasury and that part of the yield curve looks attractive.
Yes. And Ira, your thoughts?
Yeah, well... as for my top-down analysis, so I'm sure that Larry and I will find some more than some commonality here. I've been having not in my personal investing, where I control, you know, some of the management funds, I've been involved in tech stocks, but since April, if the Fed create inflation, I'm going to start building a portfolio. So I agree with Larry's infrastructure view in a big way. So I've been buying Freeport because it fits my profile of a company who's paying down debt, and copper prices weren't even as strong then. So I've been buying Freeport, and I've been buying Archer Daniel, only on breaks. And I've just been adding little bits by little bits because I think the Fed is going to create the inflation that they want. And I agree with Larry that in those stocks, which are so unloved by the markets, so unloved. You know, I'm not talking about gold years or ETF. I'm buying individual stocks, decent dividends, and have been doing yeoman's work to get their balance sheets under control. And if inflation does start to take place, because don't forget the Fed and the other central banks are telling you that's what they want to succeed at. Now, I think central banks, and every one of them is a different case. Everybody wants to pile them together because that's what will fit their models. But no situation is similar to the Fed because the Fed is the world's reserve currency. And when the Fed really wants to ramp it up, they can ramp it up. They did it initially with swap lines by opening up to different institutions than they had ever had before. But they have ways to do this. And even though it's not in their power to jawbone the dollar lower, I think that they are very happy with a weaker dollar as a corollary effect of the policy that they're going to maintain far longer than a lot of people originally thought about, because their eye is on the employment situation and inflation be damned. And I agree that they will go to yield curve control because they can't afford for long dated yields to rise, causing the government to increase the cost of, yes, even though they're heavily borrowed in the short term, I will put that caveat in there, but they have to be very careful here. So, and the day that they come out and officially announce YCC as the policy that they've reached into their toolbox, and it started as policy, I think the dollar will go down, will begin another leg down. I think the gold will then begin another leg up, and that's where we'll be. But it'll take the markets to push the Fed to that action. I think they're holding off as long as they possibly can. But we'll see, because they – the market on Friday, that was an inflation-oriented market if you look to see the individual stock. So almost complete agreement with Larry about that.
Yeah, I would expect the Fed to be quite benign before the election here, not overtly trying to influence it at all. That would be my guess. But we heard from the ECB last week, and as the euro hit 120, they're saying, "Wait a minute, boys, yeah. we don't want a strong euro either." Now the ECB is not as omnipotent as the Fed is for that reserve currency reason. And when, you know, I get asked a lot, like, you know, the dollar is going to go to trash. I'm like, yeah, what currency are you buying when you sell the dollar that you're happy with? And the answer is none, yeah. Right? Like the U.S. for all its challenges is still the biggest and best out there. And until China has free and open markets, which won't be in my lifetime, I'm quite sure, they're not taking over reserve currency status. But what might happen is that China's going to play the Silk Road card for the next number of decades. And perhaps that part of the world, goes to the Chinese yuan and uses that for trading over the dollar. And so we'll see how that all plays out. But, you know, the euro is a basket case. Yes, these common bonds they've just come out with is another can kick down the road, but ultimately it breaks apart. One of these days, Italy's just going to say, we're going to go print our own money again. So 5 years, 2 years, 8 years, like, I don't know, but so the dollar is it, and it's not going to be Japan. It can't be Canada. We're too small. And so the U.S. dollar is the reserve currency of the world, and ultimately how all these central banks are acting, gold, right? There's every scenario that I run, gold has to keep going higher. And you know, you don't want these periods of consolidation to shake you out. And I think, you know, it's the negative real yields. And when you have a central bank that wants inflation and you have a yield curve control, real yields are going to stay negative. So again, all the scenarios you want to play out, save for, you know, trading corrections, gold is something you always want to buy on dips here until that fundamentally changes. And I don't see that for a long time in the future.
And your thoughts, Ira?
Well, my thoughts on the... I'm one of the great Euro bears for more years than I care to admit to. But, you know, I did become bullish the Euro. I think I was on with you a day or two afterwards, Richard, back in late May, what I call the Schwabel pivot, when Wolfgang Schwabel, who as finance minister of Germany, was the flag bearer of austerity. When he came out over that weekend, unbelievable that we're talking about this, which was the Memorial Day weekend when we were on holiday, and he pivoted by saying that it was time for a unified Euro debt instrument, and that the more like Italy, Spain, and others who were really stressed by COVID should be given grants up to a total package of $750 billion, given grants. And the language that he used, as Adam Tooze also noted, which was, he said, if you give them loans, it's like putting stones on top of them, adding more weight. They need grants. So I that was a major pivot. And I took the own analysis. I took the over the medium term, which I would say the 2 to 4 year period, the existential breakup of the euro, I took that down to a 10% probability from what I had always held up as a 40% probability. So I think that's less now, and that if the Europeans actually proceed on fiscal harmonization as well as a true insurance banking type of system to rival, not to rival, but to mirror the FDIC, then we're talking something else. And we're in a wait and see mode. Now with the ECB meeting on Thursday, see, I know that Philip Lane came out and a few others talking about the recent strength of the euro, but we haven't heard anything from Lagarde. And I think that's by Lagarde is, I think, understands the strong euro at this point actually helps her, because this is not a trade issue. This is a finance issue. And with the euro rallying with everything that was done, yes, we all know that currencies are always a relative value trade, which makes gold so interesting. But the euro rallying helps her because Lagarde could say to the Germans, and we know Wiedemann was out last week, but the Germans, who are always concerned about currency, say, look it, we must be doing something right. The world is bidding up the euro. So they're basically applauding, supporting everything that what they're doing. So I don't think you're going to hear a word from Lagarde about any fear of a strong euro. Now, if it gets up to 125, which is another, it's not that much, another 6%, which, you know, in currency terms, this is not a whole big deal. People are getting bent out of shape over nothing. The euro for the year is probably up about 3 or 4%, negligible. I mean, you know, it was back in 08 where we saw the euro up at 160 during another type of financial stress. So we are truly living the Chinese curse of living interesting times. And where we go, we can all sit here and make our guess. But I think the gold does a lot of support just by there's nothing else to compare to it.
And just a final question for the day on other commodities. Larry, do you like the grains and industrial metals like copper?
Yeah, I don't trade the Aggie markets at all or focus on them. There was, you know, 10, 15 years ago, there was the feed the world trade, and it was interesting back then. And obviously, it's a core commodity, and trade wars with China and soybeans and things like that, you know, have some tangential issue for me. But, you know, when we talk about the infrastructure side of things, building materials are critical. Steel is big. You know, there's an ETF, an equal weight global base metals, ZMT, I've been starting to nibble at. It's got about 30% copper, about a third diversified metal and mining, so lots of different sectors. Some of the nickels, base metals, aluminum is 18%. Steel is 8% of that one. So I like that area on the reflation trade, on the infrastructure trade, putting people back to work. I think that's going to be a winner in most scenarios going forward, because we're going to have to do that. But I'm not sure on the food side.
Great. And Ira?
I totally agree with Larry about that. Because I think the infrastructure, that's all that's going to be left. And if we, you know, we go back to Olivier Blanchard's work on the multiplier effect from real investment, I think those numbers bear it out, especially with these low interest rate costs. You need to get into productive government spending rather than just sustaining present demand, and really start creating longer term investment. You know, part of that is the green infrastructure plan. You know, some of that, but there's so much more. And I think Larry's exactly right. Airports, roads, bridges, building out the grid, the electric grid in the U.S. to meet a much different energy system, your battery storage. I mean, there are massive projects where the government can spend and stimulate the economy with productive projects, but it'll take creativity and, of course, the end of hardened, polarized positions, but we'll see if we can get there.
Great. And how can our listeners learn more about your work, Larry?
Well, I guess you can watch me Mondays at 11 a.m. on BNN Bloomberg here in Canada. You can follow my new YouTube channel, Larry Berman Official. You can follow me on Twitter, Larry Berman ETF. You can check out my investment management websites, ETF Capital Management, and Sleep at Night Portfolios, ZZZportfolios.com.
Yep. And Ira?
Same place. I still don't have a full website that I'm working on it. And I really plan to get back to blogging Notes from Underground on a continual basis. And I like Larry's concept of the portfolio. You can sleep at night. I explained this to people the other day who now it's 3 days of high intense volatility. And I said, if you had your inflation portfolio in place, those actually closed, all those stocks I mentioned closed higher last week. They're down today, of course, because the onslaught against the whole basket. But that's, and find me on these on various podcasts from White Wave to Anthony Crudelli to, of course, the vast amount of work I've done with you, Richard, on from the Financial Repression Authority. These are all with guests like Larry. These, to me, these have value for people who really want to learn how to dissect markets.
Great insight. Thank you so much, gentlemen. Thank you.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.